Hey, Junkies, this week's episode is brought to you by our brand new sponsor, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers.
Do you remember a time when sleeping on the floor with your friends wouldn't have been considered weird? The management of this website invites you to a new dimension in podcasting, an experience so fun it can only be compared to a childhood sleepover. It's not just about horror.
Tom Atkins proves that any man is leading man material.
It's not just about action.
If you're going to rank Van Damme movies...
Yeah, it's up there.
I'd put it top five.
It's not just about comedy.
There's no other person in the world that loves Weekend at Bernie's more than you.
It's not just about science fiction.
Hang a scrim with, like, a beautiful comb over.
It's about nostalgia. Can you survive the Saturday night movie sleepover? It's not a movie. It's a podcast about movies.
You can follow Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. That's SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher.
Yo, wait a minute. What's that?
Something sneaking around the corner.
Here we come.
I think it's the maniac.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to a terrifyingly awesome episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmScoreRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Diane Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague. He is a novelist, he is a screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, not convicted of those suspicious deaths out by the old summer camp. He is Mr. C. Robert Carr. Kill. I did a Simpsons intro for us. Every Treehouse of Horror, they change all the names all festively, like, oh, Dan Castellella and Matt Groening. Yeah, that's what we're doing because we are talking about a horror sequel today that you may have figured out what it is by the fact that we covered the first film last week or that we told you 12 times last week what movie we were covering this week.
This is part two of our two-parter, our epic two-parter.
You don't have to be as good a detective as Tom Atkins to figure out what movie we're talking about. But before we reveal that final piece of evidence, before we get to People's Exhibit Awesome, I want to tell you that we're available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. And if you're on iTunes, please rate and review us. I want to tell you, Cargill, we got our first ever negative review on iTunes, and it was the funniest fucking thing I ever read because it was 2 stars, and all it said was, nah. That's it. Just, nah. I was like, somebody hated us, but not enough to tell us why.
Well, but it's 2 stars.
And it's not even the worst.
So it's not like you hated us. He's just like, nah.
So
this isn't for me. Okay.
I kind of want to encourage people now to give us 5 stars, but then leave a review that doesn't sound overly positive, like, or but weirdly so, like 5 stars smells like cheese or something really bizarre like that. I think that would be hilarious if our iTunes feed is full of 5-star rankings, but then reviews that don't sound overly positive by people who actually do like the show. Why? Because that shit makes me laugh. That's why. But yeah, you can, again, iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can donate as much as you want per new episode. And if we reach our goal of $100 per episode, we have a lot of exciting bonus content that we are cooking up just for our patrons. And I'm telling you, like, this stuff is going to be a lot of fun. So we really hope we get there. And if you can't donate anything now, don't worry. This show is still going to be free. But if you could, just spread the word and tell everyone who will listen and a few people who won't about Junk Food Cinema.
People who might say, nah.
People who might say, nah.
Things that make you go, nah.
Well, yes, this week we are talking about the follow-up film to last week's Maniac Cop. This is, of course, 1990's Maniac Cop, enigmatically titled Maniac Cop 2. Dos.
You have the right to remain silent.
He's still alive.
Forever. Again. Maniac Cop 2. You'll be screaming blue murder.
So yes, Maniac Cop 2, Cargill. We talked last week about how Maniac Cop and Maniac Cop 2 have this weird symbiotic relationship where they actually fit together in a way where each movie is kind of a half movie that fits together as a whole. Kind of like, and I think we compared it last week to the Godfather saga cut that you would see on TV sometimes, where they would take the flashbacks from Godfather 2 and they would put them into the first Godfather so that you kind of got more backstory about Vito Corleone. This movie is doing that with a more rich, more interesting, more diabolical backstory for one crazed killer cop, Matt Cordell, played once again by the face that you can't embrace, Robert Zadar. Because you couldn't get both of your arms around it. That face is enormous, guys. It's the size of an oven mitt.
Apparently.
Stuffed in another oven mitt.
He's got a big chin.
Rest in peace. Rest in peace.
Yeah. No, the thing about it is that the movies, they really do. You cannot watch one without the other and really know the whole story. It
Maniac
really is.
Maniac Cop 2.
Yeah.
Maniac Cop 2. Can't you watch it after Maniac Cop 1? You can't have one without the other. That's all. That's it. I promise.
That's it. All right. Yeah, no, and this is where not only does the Maniac Cop get a bit more diabolical and a bit more thoughtful, but the police and the city people end up getting more diabolical. We find out a hell of a lot more about what happened. That, as it turns out, Matt Cordell was not some violent, aggressive guy who was violating people's rights.
No.
Theoretically. I mean, he could have to a certain degree. But he was investigating corruption inside the city and had gotten too close. And the city folk set him up.
Had to go.
And sent him to Sing Sing, where then three criminals came in and stabbed him to death in the shower.
Yes.
And then we find out that maybe he died.
This is the real Paul Harvey of horror sequels, because now you know the rest of the story.
Except we're given a little piece of interesting information again, because we're like, wait, was he dead or not?
Hmm.
And that's something we find out at the beginning of the movie, where our movie opens with, again, our protagonist from the end of the last film, Bruce Campbell and
Lorraine Landon.
Yeah. And they are cleared for duty. They've been cleared of any wrongdoing.
Well, hold on. Before we get there, we have to point out the Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 type beginning of this film.
Oh, yeah. By the way, it takes 6 minutes before this movie starts.
Yes.
It is an hour and 27 minutes.
And why does it take 6 minutes before the movie actually starts?
Because we have the flash. We see the end of the last movie.
There's not even, like, you play this Blu-ray. You hit play. And the first thing that comes up, there are no credits, there's no black, it's just immediately into the end scene from the first movie again.
Yeah.
And you watch that ending scene, that ending climactic scene all over again. You get to see that great stunt once again, where Bruce Campbell's stuntman goes flying next to the police van that goes careening off the edge of the pier. Like, amazing. But it's like, okay, well, we saw this, and then the credit sequence starts, and immediately someone gets, it's that same pier, there's a lot of derelict squad car sitting around. Somebody gets into one of them and drives away. Boom. Jason's back from the grave, ready to go to work.
Yeah. And then 6 minutes in, now we are back with our, we actually meet what will become our new protagonist.
Yes.
Because.
Played by Robert fucking Davi.
Oh, yes.
Because we talked about, when we did our show in the first episode, of the first movie in the last episode, we talked about how this series is a veritable who's who of great cult film actors.
Oh, yeah.
Some of whom have already been killed off, unfortunately. Richard Roundtree, William Smith, Tom Atkins, all gone the way of the dodo thanks to Matt Cordell. Shuffled off the mortal coil at the gloved hands of Matt Cordell. But in this film, we have Robert fucking Davi coming in, looking like he just stepped out of being the creepy guy at karaoke with his fedora and his trench coat. Like, he is a detective from another time. And I absolutely love that. Like, you know what? He belongs in this movie, and he doesn't.
I'm suddenly realizing we missed the boat here, and we totally should have just played 6 minutes of last week's episode at the beginning of this episode. Like, played the ending of last week's episode and then cut in so that people would be all caught up.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Junk Food. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding, guys. Just kidding.
Yeah, so Robert Davi goes in and has a nice little scene.
Yes. So after Bruce Campbell and Lorraine Landon are cleared for, well, they're not cleared for duty. They're cleared of all wrongdoing.
Cleared of all wrongdoing.
But they have to go see the police psychologist.
Who is our other protagonist.
The other protagonist of this film.
Who, by the way, is a genre actress all her own, who is known primarily for her work on Babylon 5.
Claudia Christian.
Yeah, Claudia Christian, who also has done tons of voice work on tons of video games.
Oh, absolutely. Like Fallout 4, mm-hmm. I see among here. StarCraft, I see here. Guild Wars, I see here. Like,
yeah, not small games.
Halo,
like,
4, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, she is someone who went from being a cult actress to a TV actress to a video game voiceover actress, and has done a lot of great stuff. You, the minute you see her face, you're like, she looks familiar. I know her. Why do I know her? And then you hear her voice, and you're like, why do I know that voice? And it's like from all over the place.
Also the star of another film that, take a drink, because we are definitely talking about this at some point in the future, is maybe not the star, but she's in Jack Shoulder's The Hidden, which is a movie we definitely have to talk about at some point. But so, yeah, she's the psychologist. She's interviewing both of them. They're very, like, both Bruce Campbell and Lorraine Landon are very upset about the idea that no one seems to believe them about seeing Matt Cordell. Everybody assumes he died in prison when he was murdered, yada, yada, yada. My favorite part about this scene, though, is the way it sets up Robert Davi's character. There is a piece of editing here. There is a piece of dialogue into editing that makes me smile every time I see it, which is that she says, I can't clear you for active duty. We don't let people with emotional problems carry guns. Smash cut to a guy falls out of a window on a second story, lands on top of a truck, and then onto the ground. And then when he gets up, Robert Davi puts two 44 caliber bullets into this guy. Crash, bang, boom. Again, the stunt work in this movie. We talked about the stunt work in the first one. The stunt work in this movie makes the first one look like a 3-year-old's tumbling class. It is fucking insane.
And then this great moment of dialogue that sets up Davi in this, in which the cops are like, where were you? We went in the front. And he goes, that's why I went around back.
And they're like, it's too bad you didn't kill him. And he's, it's almost ADR as he's walking away. He says, yeah, too much damn paperwork. Yeah. And I'm like, how did that guy not die? He fell out of a 2-story window, like through the glass, hits a truck, hits the ground, and then gets shot by Robert Davi's, again, I'm not joking, Magnum, and is not dead? Seriously?
Because that's who Robert Davi is. Again, we set up the fact that this guy is about justice. He is not some rogue cop who enjoys the violence. He's someone that's trying to protect everybody. And again, this is a hallmark of this series. You are going to connect with our characters almost instantly. And it is fascinating. It's really, really well done. And of course, Robert Davi fucking sells it. And it is just entertaining as hell to see him set up like that. And then what happens? Oh, our protagonists in the first film start getting knocked off.
Oh, I love this. This, again, we talked a little bit about the comparison to Nightmare on Elm Street and how you think the blonde girl is going to be the lead of the movie, but it turns out, how effective that is? I don't even remember the blonde girl's name. I only remember Nancy.
Yeah.
That's how effective that Janet Lee type switcheroo was in Nightmare on Elm Street, and that's exactly what happens here, is you think, oh, they got Bruce Campbell back, they got Lorraine Landon back, obviously they're going to be the protagonists of the... No.
Nope.
They're both killed off. Bruce Campbell's death, by the way, is particularly horrendous. Like it's just ghastly. Like, he is reading the paper about basically himself. He's reading his own press, And Matt Criddle comes up behind him and shoves the full length of that blade that he hides inside the nightstick through Bruce Campbell's neck, which actually cuts the paper in half. All of this happening in front of a blind newspaper man who's just like, tell me what's going on. Tell me what's going on. He can't see. All he can hear is the gagging. And he touches Matt Cordell's hand, which becomes a recurring thing from the first movie about it's cold as ice.
And there's this great story where the blind newspaper guy explains why he's blind. And a grenade went off next to him, blinding him, killing the rest of his team. His platoon, and he survived lying at the bottom of a foxhole covered by dead bodies, and it was so cold, and at night they froze.
Yeah.
And then he goes, this is the first time I felt something that cold.
And this is preceded, first of all, we got to jump back a little bit in the plot, by a convenience store robbery in which the same guy that robs the grocery store in Cobra, by the way, is robbing a convenience store and waiting for the guy to come to open the safe. And Matt Criddle shows up, and this is the first time we see that there is a definite design difference in the personage of Matt Criddle. In the first movie, he's a little bit indistinguishable from Bruce Campbell in stature in the way that he's filmed. And then when you see him at the end, he still looks like Robert Zadar, but Robert Zadar having, you know, lost a knife fight with a lawnmower. But in this movie, he's so bulky and huge. He looks like a twice-baked potato in a cop uniform. Like, it is a completely different... It reminds me a lot of when different actors played Jason Voorhees and how you can kind of tell, like, who those actors were by the different physicalities. But this is the same actor. So it's more of a design thing where Matt Criddle just looks slightly different than he did in the first one, which makes sense because, you know, for a little while at least, he was, you know, at the bottom of the ocean. So there's just all these little quirks about him that I think are really interesting. But then Lorraine Landon, who after Bruce Campbell is killed, is going to go on this this sort of expose show hosted by Charles Napier. Again, this movie is chock full of cult actors. But before she gets the chance to do that, she too is murdered by Matt Criddle, which leads to another fucking amazing stunt in this movie where Claudia Christian's character is handcuffed to a steering wheel of a car that then careens down a hill, and there's actually a stunt person holding on to the side of that car as it bounces up and down these hills going down a road. And I'm like, the whole time I'm watching this, I'm very much like the end of the first one. I'm like, how did these people not die on set? This is a Born to Fight situation. How are these stunt people still alive?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it's all through the movie we get stunts like this. I mean, this, honestly, I think one of the biggest differences between Maniac Cop 2 and Maniac Cop 1 is that this feels way more like an action movie than the first one does. It has its horror elements, but honestly, I wouldn't argue with anyone that wanted to categorize this more as an action movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is the in this movie, we pretty much have no doubt that Robert Zadar is dead. Like, even though they give us this little bit of...
All pretense is abandoned.
Yeah, they gave us this little bit of information at the beginning of this movie where Bruce Campbell goes to talk to the medical examiner and finds out that he was still alive. Like, he doesn't know how, but he was still alive, and so he let him fake his death so that he could get out of there, so that he wouldn't get murdered again. But that's clearly not what the case is.
No.
Like, they didn't know. That's not what happened. And he clearly somehow came back from the dead. And there's no mystery anymore. The first movie is very much a horror mystery. And this movie is very much a horror action movie. I would argue that there's two main differences between these films. That as much as they are two parts of a whole, in just 2 years, you see the stylistic change between the 80s and the 90s.
Absolutely. I noticed that, too. There's a scene where someone's running through the streets, and I'm like, I can just start to see the neon tinges of the way that this... Like, it's not a trauma movie, but I can almost feel like that same aesthetic starting to creep into horror in the early 90s. It's just like, yeah, no, I absolutely know what you mean.
Yeah, no, it's in 88, this movie looks very much like a late 80s slasher movie. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later... 2 years later on release, all of a sudden it looks like a 90s movie. Like, it, you can see the bridging gap right there of like 1989 creeping on in and the new decade taking over. And just the way they use light and the way it's shot, even though it's the same director and the same producer and some of the same cast, this movie looks different.
It definitely does.
And it's fascinating to see the differences there. While the look is the only, and the feel of that, you know, action over mystery is the only difference, because this movie has great continuity. This movie continues and tells the story of what you just watched. I watched both of these movies back to back again last night, and man, do they flow together so well.
They absolutely do. So we're continuing on the story of the first one. Once Lorraine Landon and Bruce Campbell are out of the way, the main character of the movie becomes the psychologist played by Claudia Christian, who is now convinced that Matt Cordell is back. Once again, it's being swept under the rug by the new commissioner, played by a guy who was actually cut out of the first movie, Michael Lerner, playing a character, Edward Doyle, who's the new commissioner of police. And so he's once again sweeping under the rug, you know, keeping within the department. She goes on to Charles Napier's show and basically says, you know, these killings are the thing about this movie is, right at the same time that Matt Cordell is coming back, there is this secondary storyline about another serial killer who is strangling strippers.
And this is where this movie again does something so radically different than anything else you've ever seen.
Yes.
And that where this movie goes here is so fascinating and such an interesting turn that doesn't really make sense until the end of the movie. Like, it seems like, oh, they're doing something weird and kooky, but it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, there is a method to Cordell's madness.
Yet you notice in this movie, Matt Cordell is starting to do this thing where he specifically kills the victims of crime and aids the perpetrators. That's specific, like, there is a very specific tact to what he's doing. In the opening scene, he kills the shop owner and gives the gun back to the robber and then just walks away. And later on in the movie, we're introduced to a character who is I'm trying to remember the character's name. Turkle is his name. He is the serial killer who's strangling the strippers. We're introduced to him. He's stalking his latest victim. He shows up at her house, attempts to murder her. Matt Cordell comes in and dressed as a cop, so Turkle thinks he's been busted, but then Matt Cordell goes after the stripper and tries to strangle her. Two regular cops come in, they intervene, she's saved, the stripper named Cheryl is saved, but Matt helps Turkle escape, and then it becomes this weird anti-buddy cop movie about the killer cop and his new best friend, the other serial killer, and how they're going to work together. And like, Turkle takes him back to his apartment and he's just chatterboxing the whole time. I saw you on TV. Oh yeah, this is my place and these are my girls.
And, you know, and has this great line of dialogue that tells you everything you need to know as to why this serial killer is helping him out. And
the front page versus the
fifth page. You're the front page. I'm page five.
Yeah.
Like, it's
because you got a gimmick. That uniform's why you're on the front page. You got a gimmick.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. This guy is just fascinated by getting to know another killer.
Yeah. He's fanboying all over Matt Cordell.
And it's such an interesting dynamic. And Cordell doesn't talk. So Turkle does all the talking, figuring out what Cordell wants. And it seems at first, Like if you're, you know, it looks like it's lazy writing, that it's, how do we get this character to talk about his motivations? We'll get this character to do it for him. Instead, the entire time, Turkle's getting it wrong. And instead is misdirecting the audience and making the audience think we're about to watch one thing when we're watching something else entirely.
And true to Junk Food Cinema, these movies are rough around the edges. And I have to acknowledge a flaw here that makes me laugh so hard is that it's a big deal that Cordell is able to gasp out his own name. It's the only words he's ever spoken in the entire franchise. But it's immediately followed by the two of them sitting together and Turkle's like, what happened to you? And the film launches into a flashback of like the courtroom where Cordell was convicted and then the shower scene. I'm like, but Cordell doesn't talk. So
no, he's not. But that's just it. Is
so how is he explain? How is
he's
he like?
He's not explaining. He's explaining to the audience who's watching this movie
The audience who already knows Matt Cordell's backstory.
Theoretically.
But my point is, in the moment of the scene, in the narrative of the scene, who the fuck is he talking to? He's not talking. No. So who is communicating this backstory that moment?
I didn't get the impression that I've never gotten the impression that that scene is about him explaining his backstory.
Well, then it's really ill-placed because it literally follows the line, what happened to you?
Yeah, well, no, because that's for the audience. He's being the audience there, and then the movie is filling us in case we either, A, are seeing this in a movie theater and seeing it 2 years after we saw it in a movie theater after the first one came out, or B, are seeing this in a movie theater and did not see the first one and are just watching this second one because, I heard the first one is good, I'll watch this. So they fill in just enough information for you to know what happened to this character by playing the scene over again and using different shots of the same
scene. All I'm saying is the way that it's edited, I just imagine Matt Cordell being like, Cordell, and then being like, you want to know what happened? Well, it's actually an interesting story. So I was a hero cop, and I took a lot of things into my own hands, and people didn't like that because I was investigating corruption, and just launches into this eloquent soliloquy about what actually happened to him and then never speaks again for the rest of the movie. So the two of them form this friendship, this kind of weird partnership. So what happens is that Cheryl becomes the key witness in trying to track down Turkle, and they go to a club. Robert Davi, his partner, Claudia Christensen's character, they all go to a strip club trying to find him. They do find him. They arrest him. But Turkle, the whole time he's in prison, is like, my friend's going to come for me. You guys don't understand. My friend is going to come for me. He's going to spring me out of here. And from there.
Oh, but hold on. I want to, again, take a moment to relish just how junk foody this is. Here we have Turkle, our serial killer, who is the biggest swinging dick in the room.
Yeah.
In this jail cell. He is in there with Clarence Williams III.
What did you say?
And Danny fucking Trejo.
seriously, this movie is like a cult actor porridge. There are so many amazing cult film actors in these two movies alone.
And this is back when Danny Trejo wasn't a thing.
Like, no, Danny Trejo may have just been serving time in that cell. He may not have been an actor at all.
This was just after he'd gotten out of prison and was starting to act. And he had started out as doing a technical advising on films for prisoners. And then eventually someone said, you know what, let's use you as, and he started acting and started being the prisoner in movies. And yeah, he did Death Wish 4 and he did this. And then, of course, Robert Rodriguez made him a star in the 90s in as far as, for junk food cinemaphiles. And then we got the Danny Trejo we know as Machete now. But yeah, so Danny Trejo, Clarence Williams III in our cell with Turkle.
With Turkle. And yeah, so again, this movie is about learning more about what happened to Matt Cordell at the same time having this secondary storyline, or what I'm calling the Hyman Roth storyline, again, comparing it to the Godfather saga, this sort of secondary movie going on just in the second one that serves to create the foundation for learning more about what happened to Cordell. And again, so the whole time that Turkle's in prison, he just keeps saying that Cordell's going to break him out. And this sets up what I think is the single greatest single-man siege of a police station next to the Terminator. This is, again, a testament to how amazing the stunts are in this movie. The scene where Matt Cordell, and I want to stress this, the second movie's plot, because they've done away with the pretense of the whodunit, is incredibly streamlined. I mean, we're basically at the third act of this movie already, because there's not much else that happens. I mean, it is basically, you kill off the two leads from the first movie, you introduce the lead for this, or you introduce the lead for this movie, kill off the leads for the first two movie, suggest there's more to Cordell's backstory, introduce the Turkle character, he gets arrested, siege on the prison, you're into the finale. Like, it is bam, 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 bam. Like, it does not, it is very quickly paced.
Let's pause here.
Yeah. So in this scene, Matt Cordell comes barging into the police station and just lays waste to this place. And I think my favorite shot of this is at the very beginning of the siege, where you have all these cops at the firing range and they're all shooting at the paper silhouettes. And all of a sudden, from the darkness behind the silhouettes comes more gunfire and they're all blown away. And then just Matt Cordell slowly appears from the darkness, because again, we're kind of going by that Jaws principle of showing him as little as we have to. And then he comes in and just fucking shreds this place. Like, it is Armageddon in that police station.
And has one of those greatest B-movie genre shots of all time, in which somebody is lifted off their feet and thrown through this series of open-topped rooms.
Yes.
Smashing. And that shot is just so elegant and so well done. It's their big trailer moment in the trailer. If you've ever seen the trailer, you've seen this scene a billion times. And it's just one of those great moments where it's just like, it feels so much bigger than the rest of this film did. And that's the thing about these stunts, is that this movie feels so small, and then you see stunts that are A-list movie kind of stunts.
Yeah.
Like, they're really dangerous stuff, but they feel very grounded and down to earth until this moment where it's just like, holy fuck. Okay, Matt Cordell this is the moment in this series where he fucking becomes Jason Voorhees.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, at this moment, he is the unstoppable undead machine.
And I don't want to put too fine a point on the stunt work in this movie, but Matt Cordell spends approximately 10 of the last minutes of this movie on fire. This fucking Matt Cordell has apparently made several shots in a row on NBA Jam, because he is on fire throughout almost the entire third act of this movie. It is incredible how many fire stunts, and the prolonged shots of stuntmen on fire are in the finale of this movie.
Oh yeah.
Because what happens is Matt Cordell springs his buddy, and by proxy, Clarence Williams III and Danny Trejo out of jail. And they decide that, Turkle decides that what Cordell's plan is that they're going to go to Sing Sing and bust out an army of criminals, and then they're going to take over the city.
Because he's teaming up with criminals. That must be what he's doing.
Yeah.
That ain't what he's doing
at all. No, that's not what he's doing at all. But what's great is that, again, speaks to why this movie is more of an action film than a horror film. That's an action movie villain's plot.
Yes.
We're going to get an army of criminals and take over. That's like the setup to a Die Hard movie, where it's like, and then we're going to take over a bus or a ship or a plane.
That's one of the brilliantly wonderful things about this movie, is this movie seems like it is batshit crazy, insane, stupid in terms of what its plot is. And at this point in the movie, if you are one of those people that scoffs at movies or rolls your eyes at movies,
then why are you listening to the show, first of all?
Yeah, you would turn this off and be like, oh, fuck this movie. This is the dumbest fucking plot ever. That ain't what's going on. They're selling us one story and letting us revel in the batshitness of it.
Yeah.
And then they're going to give us something that makes so much more sense and actually leads to wrapping up this two movie series perfectly.
Yes, guys. We talked about continuity. We talked about how this movie has an amazing continuity. The real reason that Matt Cordell wants to go into that prison.
And the real reason we saw that clumsy flashback from the previous movie.
Which, by the way, is 99% the same footage of the flashback we saw in the first movie, which means the same actors in the flashback of the first movie, who are the guys that stab him in the shower, happen to be the same actors playing those characters again in Sing Sing in this movie.
Because they steal a bus, they sneak into Sing Sing, and then they lay siege to Sing Sing, not to free the army of criminals, but to kill the three guys who stabbed him to death in terrible, horrible ways.
This is nothing but vengeance for Matt Cordell. Matt Cordell is using Turkle as a means to an end, and this is the moment you realize that. And I think the performance of Leo, I believe his name is Leo Rossi.
Yeah, Leo Rossi.
Leo Rossi as Turkle is so brilliant, because at certain times he's really upsettingly eerie and just like brutal, and you buy the menace, but there's such a neurotic desperateness about him at the same time when he's in Cordell's presence, that you buy that dynamic almost of a serial killer team, where one is more of a dominant and the other one's more of a submissive. Like, it's very psychological in the way that it's constructed, and he performs both sides of that coin so well.
Yeah,
I think it's a really great performance from Leo Rossi, who, by the way, had a small part in the first film that was cut out as the mayor's assistant, which I thought was interesting. Almost as if they were like, you know what? we're going to bring you back. And I have a theory, and I'll get to that in just a minute, as to why that scene in the first one was cut. And it has to do with who they maybe originally wanted for this role. But I'll get to that in just a moment. So yeah, they break into Sing Sing. Turns out it's not to unleash this army of criminals as Turkle thinks there. And he says, there's a great moment in the prison where he's like, I'm inside your head. I can read your thoughts. I know exactly what you're thinking. And it's like, no, you have no idea. You don't have a fucking clue. And then it proceeds to just completely unwind as Matt Cordell is on fire murdering the guys that murdered him and doing most of it just by touching them so that they also are set on fire. That's what I mean. The stuntman in this movie had to have been on fire for at least 5 minutes at a time, which is insane to think about.
Yeah, but also one of the funny little bits is that when you're watching it, several of these bits are in slow motion. So you can clearly see that they built a giant Robert Zadar head.
We built this in our Tucson flame.
Yeah, and so it's clearly not Zadar. It's clearly a stuntman in a big mask.
How dare you? That's clearly Zadar. that giant inflamed face doesn't lie. No, it's not. It looks like
a giant papier-mâché head.
It looks more like they set Wilson the volleyball on fire.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're like, there really is a dude in there. This is 1990. There's a dude on fire. I'm going to allow it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to mock this movie for being that. I'm going to applaud this movie for being in an era before we used CG fire on actors.
As opposed,
we actually lit fucking dudes on fire. And this dude is lit on fire and walking in slow motion and killing people while on fire.
I will take pinata heads over CG fire.
Oh, wait.
Any day of the week.
I can't believe that you went with we built this Zadar.
As opposed to?
To this Zadar's on fire.
Oh, shit. No, I missed that.
This Zadar's on fire.
That's a fumble on my part, guys. Again, you know what? We're the creepy guys at karaoke. Sorry, Robert Davi. I have maligned you for no reason. We are clearly the creepy guys at karaoke. But here's what I think is great about what you're saying is like, yes, absolutely. You can see the strings a little bit, the papier-mâché faces, but they don't give you a chance to think about it for too long because the final stunt of this movie, I don't know that I've ever seen anything like it to this day. And it is Turkle gets mad at Zadar, realizes they're not really friends, and Zadar grabs him, sets him on fire, holds him close to him. They crash through a brick wall, fall four stories onto a bus, which then explodes, both of them on fire the entire time they're falling. I was aghast. I was like, I cannot believe anyone got away with doing this. This is the most insane thing I've ever seen. And it's in, for all intents and purposes, a horror movie.
Yeah.
I still can't believe what I'm seeing.
You're watching, and this is what's so... This is why when going back to last week's episode, when I talked about how smart these movies are, and they're very much genre bending movies, because the ending of this movie is not the good guys killing and stopping our madman. It's our madman killing another serial killer and taking himself out at the same time after having just gotten revenge on the guys who murdered him in prison.
Because, and I have a theory about that, because his job was done, his final, you know, his unfinished business, as they say with ghosts, they have unfinished business. So he reverts to being Matt Cordell. And what is Matt Cordell obsessed with?
Justice. Yeah. And that's what's so wonderful about the end of this movie. After Cordell is dead, our heroes who had played no part in stopping Zadar.
Basically our spectators
who play no part in stopping Cordell do what is super important for this story. They immediately make a choice, and that choice is what is going to protect everybody, because that choice is he's going to be buried. He's going to be exonerated. He's going to be buried.
Oh, there's a full color guard at his funeral. With
full honors.
Yeah.
And that is because that's how he will rest, when he knows that he is done and his name is clear and that his justice has been gotten. He can finally rest.
Yeah.
And So this is the first time throughout the entire series we have a full admission that, look, this is a supernatural motherfucker, and so we got to fight it supernaturally, which means we got to, you know, give him his last rites, if you will, as a cop.
Yeah.
And that at the end, Cordell is, you know, and then we finally, we have the badge put on the top, and then we have what I feel is the Phantasm moment. And it's you'll see it occasionally in films where it's like, okay, we gotta get a jump to the audience, but it doesn't make any sense. Doesn't matter if it doesn't make any sense. We need that final jump for fun.
Yeah.
Let's just have it. Bam.
But it breaks all the continuity we've created. But yeah, we need the jump. I feel like this is Larry Cohen's note. Like, no, we need the jump. We gotta have the I don't know why he's talking like this. We gotta have the jump. We gotta have it. Just put it in there.
And so, you know, Zadar, you know, Cordell reaches up, grabs the badge through, you know, breaks through the coffin, grabs the badge, pulls it down, and then bomb. And you think, oh, there must be a Maniac Cop 3. There is. But what just happened plays nothing into Maniac Cop 3 at all. Same writer, same director. No. Cordell really did die. We just need to raise him via voodoo a Catholic priest.
Do you know what Maniac Cop 3 is? If Matt Cordell is Frankenstein's monster, Maniac Cop 3 is the Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because it's a movie in which he is, just to give you guys a little backstory, we're not going to talk about Maniac Cop 3 because it's largely garbage, unfortunately. But
we will mention that it does have Robert Forster and Jackie Earle Haley again.
This frickin' franchise cannot stop vomiting up amazing cult film actors.
Yeah.
But what that movie is about is a female cop who is wrongly accused of using excessive force to take out a criminal during a hostage situation, and Maniac Cop is resurrected by voodoo because it's
1992, and that's what you do.
So voodoo. And it basically goes after everyone who is responsible for her being railroaded because it mimics his own story.
Yeah, it ties into what, yeah.
But it's like, it's his girlfriend. That's the only woman for him. It's like, it is the fucking Bride of Maniac Cop. So it's terrible. It's an awful movie. I can't recommend it, except that it's kind of fun to watch with that lens, at least. But what the ending of Maniac Cop better leads into than Maniac Cop 3 is an insanely bad rap song from an artist named Jay Chataway.
Oh, my God. Again, the difference between 1988 and 1990 what you have to understand in context, 1988 was the year that rap went mainstream. But it still wasn't mainstream enough to have bled into movies. That was 1989, where it was really like, holy shit.
Yeah.
We had Ghostbusters 2, and the majority of the Ghostbusters 2 soundtrack was rap songs.
Was Bobby Brown.
And Dougie Doug.
Yes.
But yeah, so by 1990, what do we have at the end of our slasher movie?
We have Jay Chataway's Maniac Cop rap, which makes, I swear to God, which makes LL Cool J's Deepest Bluest from Deep Blue Sea an Oscar-worthy best song of the year.
This is terrible.
Let's listen to a little bit of it right now. You better watch out when you hear that sound. It means that the Maniac Cop's around. Once upon a time, he was a super cop, but the bad guys framed him to make him stop. They put him in prison where they tried to kill him. But he broke out, now he's the villain. Bullets won't hurt him. I know it sounds like jive, but when it's true, he's dead. What the actual fuck, Cargill? I just can't. I'm actually a big fan of rap and hip hop, and I can't. And I'm a big fan actually of terrible movie songs, but even this one goes a little too far for me.
Yeah, no, you know me. I love this cheesy stuff. I karaoke Ghostbusters 2 stuff when I can find it.
Well, I guess we're going to have to take control and recommend.
Have to take control. Gotta take control.
On our own. This really is the karaoke episode of Junk Food Cinema.
Well, I guess we're gonna have to take control.
On our own. Hey, so remember me telling you that Leo Rossi, who plays Turkle in this movie, was originally cut out of the ending of Maniac Cop 1? Evidently, the plan for Maniac Cop 2 was to have the part of Turkle played by Joe Spinell, and it was going to bridge Maniac and Maniac Cop, because Joe Spinell was going to be playing his character from Maniac, which is really interesting when you consider.
That's insane.
When you consider what I talked about last week about the fact that the first Maniac Cop exists was Larry Cohen trying to get William Lustig to do a sequel to Maniac, and William Lustig saying, I don't really think it lends itself to a sequel. Picture Maniac Cop 2 as potentially a bridge between Maniac and Maniac Cop, where, like, that to me That would have been amazing. I think I would have.
Oh yeah, like if he goes in and then you see all the mannequins.
Yes. Like
holy shit.
The timeline would have had to have been tweaked because if you know anything about Maniac, he dies at the end. So the timeline would have had it been tweaked, but what a fucking... Unfortunately, it didn't work out because Joe Spinell passed away. So I believe that the plan was always to do that. Joe Spinell passes away before they're finished making Maniac Cop 1. They cut Leo Rossi's scene from Maniac Cop so that he can be Turkle in Maniac Cop 2, is my theory what happened. I know for a fact that the original plan was to have Joe Spinell play Turkle, so I feel like that's the reason they cut that scene from the ending of Maniac Cop. Not because it didn't fit, but because they wanted Leo Rossi to play Turkle and not the mayor's assistant.
He's fucking great.
He's amazing in this.
He's really great. I mean, that's the thing about this whole series, man. I mean, this whole series, this is what at first glance is cheesy 80s knockoff bullshit slasher stuff in an era when they're taking the slasher movie seriously and no one else is. What you have to understand, Maniac Cop came out in 88. By 88, fucking Jason Voorhees had gone to fucking New York City and Freddy Krueger was more comedy than horror.
Freddy Krueger had been in an NES, had been inside a Nintendo.
Yes.
By this point.
You know, these movies started being so tongue-in-cheek and just being, you're just here to watch the kills. You don't really care about this as a horror movie.
Yeah.
Actual other horror movies in the genre were branching out and doing weirder and weirder things. You had Clive Barker starting to take over with the Hellraiser movies, which aren't slasher movies. They're something very different. You have stuff like Warlock coming out, you know, where they're playing around with witchcraft and they're everybody's getting weirder and weirder, or having throwbacks like you throwbacks to like Atomic 50s monster movies with Tremors. Mm-hmm. Like, and here's somebody playing it straight, and nobody in these fucking movies, not the director, not the writer, not the actors, not the stuntmen, half-ass these fucking movies.
That's exactly right.
That's what's so interesting about the Maniac Cop series, is nobody half-asses these movies. They know they're making something that is low budget and potentially campy, and they're working their damnedest to give the audience what they want without having to wink at the camera and go, we know this is shit. They're like, no. We're going to make a real fucking movie. And if you think it's shit, you can go watch another movie. But the audience that's going to watch this is going to get a serious fucking movie with a real writing and real top-notch actors fucking giving it their all. And they do. Like, nothing in these films is phoned in.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I feel like the only reason Maniac Cop 3 doesn't have that same level is because William Lustig walked off the set. It was a troubled production and he left. I think...
I don't think he wanted to make the third one.
No, I don't think he did either.
He told a story that works in two.
Well, his cut of the movie came in at 51 minutes. He didn't want to shoot anything else.
Of three?
Of three. Oh, and it's Jesus. Like, you can't release a 51-minute movie. I think you're absolutely right.
A feature.
He, rather than half-ass, it was like, no, I'm done, guys. I'm not going to I can't just fart out more content for something I don't believe. I'm just done. I'm off.
Yeah.
So I feel like you're absolutely right. I feel like, and this is what I love so much about... This is what, to me, creates the divide between a bad movie that's just bad and you should never waste your time on it, and the kind of movies that we love, is when there is a genuine, concerted effort by someone with a vision to make something extraordinary, whether they hit that height or not. Sometimes there's as much to be gained by watching them attempt with every fiber of their being to create something spectacular than if they actually do it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like watching high level high school or college ball.
Yeah.
You know, where is this the NFL? No, it's not the NFL. No. But watching these guys play under these conditions, fuck yeah, that's a game.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. This is a B movie. It knows it's a B movie. It knows it doesn't have a fucking budget. It knows it's going to make its money back in the box office just because it's got the words maniac in it.
Truth.
So it doesn't have to be great, but they sure as hell try.
They absolutely do. And I think that's what's so admirable about it. And I want to share another little tidbit here about Leo Rossi. he's hell of an act. He's a hell of a committed actor. We're talking about people giving it their all. He actually visited strip clubs to research this character and was...
I visited strip clubs to research this episode.
Well, here's what's crazy. Yeah, right. He was thrown out of one because he made some of the strippers uncomfortable with his, like, intense eye contact.
His leering gaze.
Yeah.
Method acting.
Yeah, and not only that, but William Lustig apparently, again, giving it their all, convinced Leo Rossi to set his arm on fire. He's like, oh, no, it's fine. So William Lustig did it first to demonstrate that you can set your arm on fire, you know, in a stunt suit and be fine. And then Leo Rossi did it. Like, it's just fucking amazing. Like, everyone involved in these, especially these first two movies, they believe in what they're making and they are giving it their all. And what ends up on the screen is something spectacular.
Yeah.
Is it the NFL? No, but
it's great college ball.
It is great college ball for sure. Now, one person who may not agree with that, unfortunately, is Bruce Campbell, who has jokingly stated at conventions that he doesn't even like being reminded that this film exists because apparently he was going through a messy divorce during filming, and that's kind of why he agreed to do it. And apparently anyone who brings up Maniac Cop 2 at a convention will be thoroughly tongue-lashed by Bruce Campbell, and some fans bring it up intentionally just for the honor of being assaulted. Oh, and yet, but that's Campbell.
That is Campbell has such a weird, weird relationship with fans that way. He has a great little film he made called Finalysis, which is all about it was turning the lens on fans, and it's a really cool documentary that he made, and he toured around with it. And I've seen him live at the Draft House a number of times, and there's always those people that like try to get the Bruce Campbell tongue lashing, but at the same time, Bruce Campbell has no problem shitting on movies he's been in and no problem holding back. I remember, God, like 15 years ago, running into him at the Draft House after one of these shows, and we were talking, and we were just talking about various movies, and I brought up Dead Alive, aka Brain Dead, and he just went off, and he's like, don't ever say that around Sam Raimi. Like, this Peter Jackson guy just totally ripped off Raimi. And yeah, like, and it was just, and he had no problem like lashing into it, and doesn't, you know, bring up Congo, he'll shit all over Congo. Like he's got no filter.
That movie should be on the endangered species list.
But I don't understand why he would hate this one.
No, this is one if I were Bruce Campbell, I would be very proud of.
Like, in terms of the stuff that he's done, I mean, yeah, the Evil Dead stuff exists on a different level, but. Yeah. We say the Evil Dead stuff. Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness exist on a different level.
Yeah.
Evil Dead 1 is one of those movies you just have to love from a historical aspect because it's not nearly as good as anything else in the series.
See, that's so strange because I get where you're coming from on that, but I still like it the best. I still like Evil Dead more than any other movie in that franchise.
Yeah. But I
understand what you're saying.
Yeah,
sure.
Raimi had no idea where to put a camera, didn't fully have his mind wrapped around storytelling as he would. Like, when he essentially remade the movie with Evil Dead 2, he really showed who he was and what he could do.
I'll agree with that.
And
sure.
And don't get me wrong, I like Evil Dead. But Evil Dead, I would argue that Maniac Cop's a better film than the original Evil Dead.
I can't argue with that either.
But sure. I would then put Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness well above either of the Maniac Cop movies. But those are kind of holy grails of B film movie making. Like, it's an A-level actor or A-level director working in B movie medium, and that's where a lot of our greats come from. You know, that's essentially, you know, Raimi I honestly think that Raimi is going to, at the end of the day, be viewed as his generation's John Carpenter. He came around the same time as Carpenter, but like much younger. Mm-hmm. And he's still kicking around and still has great movies left in him, I believe. But he, this movie, this is B movie guys. Like, these are not A-list directors and writers working in the B-movie oeuvre. This is B-movie guys at their peak.
Sure.
And calling on a bunch of B-movie actors and having them all fucking deliver.
Absolutely.
Like, just fucking deliver. And these movies, the result is truly entertaining trash.
Yeah.
Like it is, the movie never, you know, and I should know. I'm going to take that back. I'm actually going to take those words back. I honestly think this movie aspires to a lot more than things in this genre does. I think one of the greatest genre bending things ultimately about these two films is that with all of our other monster men, our slashers from the 80s, they were wronged.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the people that were the killers were not good people, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. Was Freddy Krueger murdered terribly? Yes. But Freddy Krueger was a child molester.
Like, come on,
that
dude.
They got rid of the child molesting
You can't
part.
Get revenge for somebody getting revenge. Come yeah. on. That's doubling down on the revenge.
Yeah. Yeah, something
that's
horrible.
That's the KFC revenge double down.
Something horrible happened to
Jason Voorhees.
To Jason Voorhees. But still, Jason Voorhees was a motherfucker and came back as an awful motherfucker.
It's like his mother was awful. You got revenge on the camp counselors long ago. Now you're killing kids on their way to New York.
Yeah. But Matt Cordell was genuinely wronged.
Yeah.
He was a good guy that was wronged and then goes about a very weird, twisted, confused revenge scheme that works.
Yeah.
Like that by the time you get to the end of the second movie, all of a sudden the deaths in the first movie make a hell of a lot more sense. This like he was putting the pressure on these people by scaring everyone of a cop. And that because the thing is, and what is subtly hidden in there, nobody cares when a cop shoots and kills a bad guy. We just don't.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, well, thank God that guy's off the street. Like there's a bloodlust in our culture that thinks that's okay. So it's only when a cop kills an innocent person that we're like, whoa, why so violent?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this movie shines a light on that and makes us afraid of something that would become a flashpoint just a few years after this.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so prescient about this. Maniac Cop doesn't come after Rodney King. Maniac Cop comes 3 years before Rodney King. Like, this is, you know, we aren't talking in our culture about how scary cops are. This movie does. And that ultimately this movie is about our fear of that and how much corruption can exist in the government to cover up. Here we have a serial killer dressed as a cop that we're not even sure is a cop, but we're not going to investigate the cops and we're going to shine the light elsewhere because we don't want this to reflect badly on us. We don't really care so much about who's really killing. We care that we don't look bad. And that is at the heart of what these movies are. And so this movie does aspire to talk about something a little bigger than what you would talk about in most of these films. So it's so weird that these films have been relegated to the dustbin of history when there's so much going on, when they're so entertaining, and that they have so much to say and do, and that they've got a very weird consistency to them and mm-hmm. continuity that tells a great story that you can't understand until the end of the second movie. And it's just, it's so well done. And I think it's so smart. And I think it's a shame that these movies aren't regarded with the same love that we have for of all things, Friday the 13th,
yeah,
which is a series that people love, but you never see a Friday the 13th movie show up on any best horror lists.
This is true.
Like Nightmare on Elm Street will show up on almost every top 10 or top 20 list because the original Nightmare on Elm Street was scary as fuck. But the Friday the 13th movies were just Halloween knockoffs. And Cunningham denied that for like 30 years until he was like, yeah, no, we were totally ripping off Carpenter. No shit. Well, I'm shocked to find that there's gambling in this establishment. But
for those of you playing at home, that's a Casablanca reference in our episode devoted to Maniac Cop 2. Because that's the kind of show that we run here.
And that's the kind of listeners we have. So,
although we've compared Maniac Cop to Godfather about five times in the last two episodes.
Yeah, so I thought Casablanca was okay to bring in. White man,
yeah.
You mean you have keep comparing it to Godfather and Godfather 2. But I do not disagree.
I was going to say, you can't possibly disagree.
I think you're right in that and that might even be what they were, you know, this is how these movies get made.
Yeah.
You know, when you make a low-budget movie like this, it's a bunch of people who love doing it because you're not doing it for the fucking money. And I will tell you that many of the people we talk about, if you go back and if you have not gone back and listen to our Modern Junk Food Masters series, those people, they do make these kind of movies and they do it for the love. And these people love these old movies. They love great movies. They love trashy movies. And they go, what if we could merge it together? What if we made Godfather and Godfather 2? You know, what if we did that? What if we tied it in with Maniac? You know, what if we made these films all one series? Like, that's the type of stuff that these folks do. And it is, and it's amazing. And it shows in this. And are these movies rough around the edges? Yeah. Find me a slasher movie in the 80s that isn't. Like, I would say, like, the closest thing you could come to a slasher movie that has no jagged edges is probably Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Ooh. Take a drink, because we'll definitely cover that at some point.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, you're going to find...
With a much better theme song than this one has.
Yes. Well...
Dokken versus Jay Chataway is not much of a fight. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, no, the end stuff, but I would still... I love the theme for Maniac Cop. I love that, which we talked about last episode. I just love
that. Not the rap song, but the actual score. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
His theme, Maniac Cop's theme, is just... It's so haunting. It really is. But yeah, so there we go. There you have it. The Maniac Cop movies.
Watch them. We cannot stress enough. Watch them as a double feature. Do it, do it, do it.
Watch
do
it back
not
to back.
Deprive yourself of that experience. And that is actually why the junk food pairing is going to sound eerily familiar to last week.
Is it Voodoo Donuts?
It's not Voodoo Donut. It's Gordo's, which is another establishment here in Austin that makes donuts that have no right to be, that are so monstrous and so much... They add things to donuts that you would never think to do that create these abominations that you can't help but love. I'm looking at, for example, one called the Mother Clucker that has a fried chicken strip with honey butter on a donut. The Maniac Cop movies... by the way, cops love donuts. It's a notoriously traditional staple of their diet, so that's very appropriate. But the specific thing about places like Gordo's and Voodoo Donut is they're not satisfied making one thing that exists in a box. You understand what a donut is. You understand the concept of frosting on a donut, sprinkles on a donut. They're like, fuck frosting and fuck sprinkles. We're putting chicken strips with honey butter on donuts. And as crazy as that looks, you want to combine slasher and action... You want to take the heroes out of the equation entirely? That's fine. It still can be delicious if you do it right, and that is something that Voodoo Donuts and Gordo's prove to us on a daily basis.
I would actually take that a step further.
Go further with it. Do it.
I would take us to Gibson's and get their Gordo's donut sliced in half, served with a burger on it.
Oh, yes.
So a burger on a Gordo's glazed donut.
That's actually at the Gordo's Public House, so it's still Gordo's.
Oh, they can do that there too?
Yeah,
for
sure.
There it is. Then the burger at Gordo's.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. Take a donut, make it the fucking bun of a burger, and you have
Maniac Cop
2. I've been saying this for years, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. Please follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, please feel free to contribute. Be a patron to our brand spanking new Patreon account. If you have any money that you can spare every time there's a new episode out, it helps us keep the lights on here. We really appreciate that. If we get to our goal of $100 per episode, we will be producing bonus content just for patrons, which I think you guys will really enjoy. So spread the word on that. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at facebook.com/massaworm.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. And check out all the great happenings here at filmschoolrejects.com. Every day there's something new to enjoy. And you know what? I'm going to end the show very familiarly and let you know and warn you that you have the right to remain silent forever. Again.
Again.
Hey guys, just one more shout out for our very special sponsor, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. Remember back in the day when you'd have a sleepover with your friends and you'd go to the video store and rent as many movies as your parents would let you, or just, you know, rent more than they'd let you but wait till they fell asleep because your parents were alcoholics? Well, our buddies Dion and Blake are reliving their childhoods with a nostalgic movie podcast called Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. Some of the highlights of their 50-plus episodes include 1989's Batman, John Carpenter's The Thing, Dick Tracy, The Warriors, Rocky, Smokey and the Bandit, Big Trouble in Little China, Labyrinth. Okay, you know what? I'm hearing a lot of movies in this list that we either have or are planning to cover here at Junk Food Cinema. So yeah, I'd say we're cut from the same cloth. It's cheesecloth, make no mistake about it. So after you're done listening to our show, go check out Dion and Blake and Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at saturdaysleepovers.podwitz.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, and just about everywhere podcasts are available. You can also follow them on Facebook and Twitter.